For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. If you want to move your chair over so you can see David, you're welcome to. For new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zengate, and I'm extremely happy to have with us this morning David Loy as our guest speaker. David is an important person to me in American Buddhism, one of the great writers and spokespersons for how we can adapt the bodhisattva practice and the bodhisattva way to the current situation of our life in the world, in our culture, in this time and place. He's written quite a few really excellent, important books. For example, A New Buddhist Path, Enlightenment, Evolution, and Ethics in the Modern World, I think his newest. The Great Awakening, A Buddhist Social Theory, very important book. Money, Sex, War, Karma, Notes for a Buddhist Revolution. A Buddhist History of the West, Studies in Lack. One that's dear to us, The Dharma of Dragons and Demons. A number of these books will be available afterwards. We'll have extra time for David. We're not going to do the usual temple cleaning this morning, but there will be books for sale afterwards in the kitchen. So I'm very happy to have David here talking to us about the bodhisattva practice and way and how it works in our place and time. So.
Thank you, Taigen. I'm really delighted to be here. And once again, good morning, everyone. Please sit comfortably, and as we go along, feel free to adjust your posture, etc. Can everyone hear me okay in the back? Is it all right? If there's ever any problems, just raise your hand and I'll try to adjust. But I think the acoustics are pretty good in this room, yes? Yeah? As Taigen just said, I'd like to talk about the bodhisattva path in the context of today. But going back to the very beginning, starting with something that was emphasized by the Buddha himself, who didn't talk about the bodhisattva path in the way that we often do now, but I think he was perhaps the best exemplar. Anyway, the Buddha emphasized impermanence and insubstantiality. Impermanence, everything is changing. And insubstantiality is a fancy word to express the fact that nothing has any self-existence or reality on its own. Everything is dependent on lots of other things. And this is so true, impermanence and insubstantiality. One of the really interesting implications of it is how it applies to Buddhism itself. Impermanence and insubstantiality really mean that the world isn't the way we tend to see it, as a collection of separate things that occasionally bump into each other or interact with each other, but rather the world is a confluence of processes. Everything is a process, and all those processes, every process is dependent on lots of other processes. And of course, that includes us. Our sense of self is a confluence of those processes, and Buddhism itself. So the emphasis on impermanence and insubstantiality means that Buddhism isn't what the Buddha taught, it's what he began. And it's been really important for the way that Buddhism has developed. You know, unlike some other spiritual traditions where missionaries go to a new land and they sort of impose their way of understanding on that different culture, sort of Buddhism has spread throughout Asia by interacting with the local cultures. And I think maybe the best example of that is our own tradition, Chan, right? Or Zen, as it became in Japan. Chan was a result not just of Mahayana Buddhism coming to Japan, but the way it interacted with native traditions, especially Taoism. So it's sometimes said that if Buddhism was the father of Chan, Taoism was the mother. And of course, a lot of Taoist language is still found in Zen. Right? Buddhism has always spread in this way. There's been this kind of mutual causality, as Joanna Macy talks about it, where Buddhism would influence the culture but also be influenced by it. And the really interesting thing now that Buddhism, including Chan or Zen, now that Buddhism really confronts its greatest challenge ever, now that it comes, you know, not just to the West, but to the modern world, not just to the modern world, but a secular, technocratic world, totally different than any of the other pre-modern cultures that it encountered in Asia. It's this fascinating question, okay, again, how is Buddhism influencing modernity and how is it being influenced by it? Because it's really a conversation or a dialogue, again, of mutual causality, mutual influence. Again, there's been interaction with Western spiritual traditions, especially Christianity. Buddhist-Christian dialogue, I think, has been in some ways the most interesting, the most successful, the most fruitful of modern interreligious dialogues. But nonetheless, that's not the main action. That's not the main place where Buddhism, I think, has been interacting with modern culture. I'd say so far it's mostly psychological. Not just things like neuroscience, but really psychotherapists thinking about how it is that today we have many psychotherapists who are not only practitioners, but incorporate some Buddhist practices into their own therapy. And some of them even are Dharma heirs themselves within their own traditions. So I think there's been a very, very fruitful interaction between Buddhism and psychotherapy. And now, of course, I guess we could include within that the mindfulness movement. In some way, it's part of the same thing. It's part of what you might call the psychologization of Buddhism. But there's something else, another interaction that is our main concern this morning. Right. I think an interaction that is all the more important given the fact that, you know, Buddhism doesn't just come into a modern world that's secular and technocratic and so forth, but a modern world that it seems to many of us is a world in crisis. Clearly, for some time, many of us have been aware of the ecological crisis, which isn't just climate change. That's just the tip of the iceberg. It's something much bigger than that. Right? We really have a full-blown ecological crisis that's really very likely the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced. At least it's hard to imagine, for me anyway, a bigger one. People like E.O. Wilson, the renowned Harvard biologist, make the point that we're well into now the sixth great extinction event, to the point that by the end of this century, he says, half of all plant and animal species on this earth could be extinct or will be so weakened that they might go extinct soon thereafter. That's an extraordinary thing. An ecological crisis caused by one particular species, that is to say us. Species always come and go, but they're disappearing between 100 and 1,000 times faster than natural, than would normally happen because of our influence. What does that mean for a Buddhist tradition that emphasizes compassion? I'm not quite sure how you do it in this temple, but certainly in the practice centers where I've meditated, we recite the four vows every day. What's the first vow? Living beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. And yet as a species, we seem to be doing our very best to extinguish as many as possible. How does Buddhism respond to something like that? In addition to the ecological crisis, which really seems to me a kind of a symptom of a civilization that's lost its way, a civilization of ravenous, incessant growth, an economic and political system that has to keep growing if it's not going to collapse. In addition to, you know, the ecological, more and more it seems like we're heading into further economic and now political crises as well. Maybe I don't need to elaborate on that, but that's certainly a matter of grave concern for many of us. And so the big question for here, it's not about politics per se, but the question is, what does Buddhism have to say about all this? What does our practice, how does our practice engage with this situation of great crisis? What can Buddhism offer that can help us understand and respond to socio-ecological challenges? And what does our critical situation today imply about how we have been understanding and practicing Buddhism? It's a really two-sided thing. I think the crisis actually pushes the Buddhist tradition to clarify its message, its teaching, in order to be most liberative at this particular time. There's a lot of things to talk about, but we don't have time to talk about all of them. But in particular, the one I would like to talk about is understanding the Buddhist response to the kind of situation that we're in today, understanding it in terms of a new conception of the Bodhisattva path. I think I don't need to talk about the origins of that path or the different forms that it's taken in Asia. In fact, I'd be quite self-conscious or embarrassed to do so sitting next to Taigen here, who's written so eloquently on the Bodhisattva archetypes. But the issue is, how does that path, again, bringing that path in relationship to the kind of challenges we face today, what is it within it? What is it about it that makes it so relevant to our situation, but also what is there that needs to be modified in order to make it most effective? In the last generation, it seems to me that socially engaged Buddhism, in the United States at least, which is what I'm most aware of, socially engaged Buddhism has made some pretty big strides in the sense that it's now generally accepted that social engagement can be a part, even an important part, of one's own personal development. That is to say, it's now, I think, much more broadly accepted than it was a generation ago, how important it is to do things like prison dharma, or hospice work, or maybe helping homeless people. To use an analogy, I think that we're much better today in pulling drowning people out of the river What we're not yet much better at is asking why there are so many more people drowning in the river. Who or what is pushing them in the river upstream? What I'm pointing to is the fact that traditionally the response to the Bodhisattva path has tended to work more on the individual level, that is to say, individuals helping other individuals. And what's clear about our situation today is that, important as that is, it's not sufficient. That we also need to find ways to address what might be called structural dukkha, institutionalized dukkha, systemic dukkha, which is awkward for Buddhism, because if you look at the history of Buddhism, if you look at the way it developed, it tended to understand the problem in individual terms. If you go back to the origin, South Asia, right? The problem is our own individual karma, the way our own individual minds work, and that's the focus on understanding the problem in individual terms and transforming our individual minds in response to that. Buddhism historically has not been very good at what we would call social justice. That wasn't something that developed in Asia. Not to any large degree, anyway. But now we're in a situation where it's very clear that we have to somehow expand to incorporate that understanding of dukkha, that understanding of suffering. So this is the first thing about the Bodhisattva path, that whereas individually it would be helping individuals, and maybe the most important thing was helping other individuals wake up, now we see we have to be able to address the larger social context. I'm reminded of the Brazilian Archbishop Dom Helder Kumara, who back in the 60s and 70s was famous when he said, "When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask why there are so many poor, they call me a communist." Is there a Buddhist equivalent? You know, when we help homeless people or go into prisons to teach Dharma, we're called bodhisattvas. But when we want to ask questions about the kind of economic system we have, why is it in the wealthiest nation in the history of humanity we still have so many homeless people? A couple of years ago, there was something like 2 million school children who were homeless. Why? Well, when we ask those questions, some Buddhists say, well, don't bring in your lefty politics here. That has nothing to do with Buddhism. I think it has a lot to do with Buddhism, because the fundamental deal with Buddhism has to do with suffering. Understanding the roots of suffering, which are not always individual. Certainly this applies ecologically as well. The tendency, of course, is to work, the Buddhist tendency, maybe it's not just Buddhist, but to understand the importance of working on the individual level. So we're aware of the ecological crisis due to carbon, the fact that we're putting so much carbon into the atmosphere with our fossil fuels. And sure, it's important to reduce our own carbon footprint. It's important to drive hybrid or electric cars, if we are going to drive. Solar panels, reducing one's, you know, eating locally, etc., etc. Sure, all that's important. But as Bill McKibben said, even if a very large number of us did that, if we did everything we possibly could to reduce our carbon footprint, that basically would have no impact whatsoever, he says, unless we also engage politically. Because we also have fossil fuel companies that are making sure that they're still deriving so much profit from producing the fossil fuels, from us burning the fossil fuels. So we can't really resolve the ecological crisis or even just the climate change side of it without also addressing the structural. Why is it that basically the fossil fuel interests have so much political influence? They're still receiving incredible subsidies. Getting back to the Bodhisattva. It really seems to me that the Bodhisattva path may well be the most important contribution of Buddhism to our present situation. Some of you, I think, must be familiar with Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest. It's a very important book, pointing out that, and I think this is something to remember when we feel discouraged, he points out that right now something has happened that's never happened before in human history. A very large number of groups, mostly small and local, have been springing up around the world to work for social justice and sustainability. There's no communist conspiracy. They're not organized from the top. Instead, he has a marvelous chapter where he describes these groups springing up as if they were the immune system of the earth springing up to defend itself. Wonderful. Originally, he estimated between 1 million and 1.5 million of these groups. But now I think he would say well over 2 million. Marvelous, wonderful. So things are happening. We don't always hear so much about it because it's not in the interest of the mainstream media to emphasize them, right? The mainstream media are corporations that make their money from advertising. They have other concerns. But it's important to realize that, as I said, when we feel discouraged. But also thinking about Buddhism in the context of that, socially engaged Buddhism. I think we are a very, very, very tiny part of this much larger movement. But what we may have to offer that's distinctive is the idea of the Bodhisattva path. Maybe we're not the only spiritual group within it, that within this larger movement, that would talk about that. But I think there's something very clear about the way that the Bodhisattva path, I think, is a very distinctive contribution, because what it emphasizes is the importance of bringing together the kind of personal or individual transformation that we're working toward in our usual practice with the kind of social transformation that involves social engagement. That is to say, the practice of the Bodhisattva, I don't want to say that there's two practices, but I think that there's two sides to the practice. He or she continues to work on their zazen, their meditation, and so forth, to be transformed, but at the same time, they know that that's not sufficient. And one way to say it is, for many Buddhist practitioners still, there's the sense that to be engaged socially is a kind of distraction. Maybe they grudgingly accept it, but it's a distraction from their own personal practice. And I think we're clearly at a point now where we can see that that way of thinking doesn't work anymore, that we have to understand that engagement in the world is as much a part of our practice, as much as part of our personal transformation practice, as sitting on our cushion. In fact, in some ways, it's the more important practice, because that's really where the rubber hits the road. So when we, I mean, here's one way to say it. When we meditate, my tradition, Sambo Kyodan or Sambo Zen, a lot of emphasis on Kensho, some initial opening, some initial awakening, you might say, a little glimpse, maybe. But the idea that somehow that's transformative, that somehow that's it, is very misleading. It's like one has a little glimpse, but the whole point is one's deep-seated, deep-rooted, self-preoccupied ways of thinking, the habits, ways of thinking and acting, those don't just automatically disappear. The real challenge of practice is integrating that little bit of insight into how we actually live in the world so that we become less self-preoccupied. How does one do that? Well, by living in the world in a different sort of way, in a more selfless way. The point being that the one who benefits most from the social engagement of the bodhisattva is the bodhisattva himself or herself. It's part of our own personal transformation, not just concerned for the larger transformation. I'm reminded of my all-time favorite quotation, curiously, not by a Buddhist, but by a Nilvedantin, Nisargadatta, who said, "When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life flows." So the insight is the realization, letting go of ourselves, forgetting ourselves, as Dogen would say, and realizing our intimacy with the 10,000 things, as he puts it in the Genja Koan. So there's the insight, but how does one live that insight? What does it mean to live that insight of non-duality? Well, that's called love or compassion. It's to live in the world in a different way. And that's what the bodhisattva path, it seems to me, is all about. Certain things about the bodhisattva path are, you know, pretty straightforward. Maybe the first thing to emphasize is that it's not about telling us what to do. Rather, it's about telling us how to do it. Right? I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that Shakyamuni Buddha or Bodhidharma or Dogen don't really tell us directly how to respond to the kind of social ecological crises we're facing today. They weren't their crises, right? The Buddha wasn't dealing with climate catastrophe, so we can't expect to find specific suggestions in any of the original texts. But so likewise, thinking about our little eco-dharma group in Boulder, people are doing a variety of things. One of our members is very good at helping people reduce their individual carbon footprint. So when my wife and I bought a new home, he was very good at helping us do an energy audit and, you know, fixing up our home in that regard. He's good at solar panels, electric cars, and so forth. Another member of ours, a retired banker, has a very important skill, being pretty conservative himself, he knows how to talk to Republicans. So he regularly goes to Washington and lobbies for a carbon tax as a member of Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm a member of 350.org. Have done different things at different times with them. Most recently, working, pushing my college, the trustees of my college, to divest from fossil fuels. Not very successfully so far, I'm sorry to say, but you know, we're persisting. You know, it's not so much the money, but the symbolism, the fact that institutions like colleges and churches should not be profiting from fossil fuels, that we should sort of push to raise those kind of questions. Some of us sat in front of a bank, Wells Fargo Bank in Boulder, kind of sit-in, so people couldn't get in, as a way of highlighting the fact that Wells Fargo is one of the big banks supporting the pipelines. So, of course, the people who wanted to go in the bank, they just had to go in the back door, which is fine, but we made our point. Yeah. So, but here's my point. Which of those is the proper Buddhist response to the kind of ecological crisis, if that's what we're looking at? Which of those is the proper Buddhist response? And I think all of them, right? And maybe lots more. I mean, I have a background as a draft resister during the Vietnam War, and I wouldn't be surprised. I think at a certain point, maybe not very far in the future, we're going to need things like civil disobedience. And that, too, I think is quite compatible with Buddhism. Again, Buddhism doesn't tell us specifically what to do. We have to put on our thinking caps and analyze as well as we can. But Buddhism, including the Bodhisattva path, tells us a lot about how to do it. For example, the emphasis on nonviolence, right? And it's not just that, but more broadly, the violence comes from a kind of sense of separation, the dualizing, right? It's so easy, it's so difficult to avoid getting into the way of thinking we're the good guys and they're the bad guys, and somehow the issue is about defeating them. This and a certain kind of patronizing or superior attitude that can go along with that. And I think Buddhism is very good. I think this goes along with the fact that the Buddhist tradition doesn't really emphasize good versus evil in a kind of Abrahamic sense, but it's much more delusion versus wisdom, and the realization that we're all caught up in systemic delusion and that we have to work through that. Something else that I think is really important in the Buddhist tradition is the emphasis on what you might call pragmatism. This is especially important if you compare it, say, to what's happened so often with political movements in the past, thinking of the old left and the new left getting so caught up in debates, theoretical debates about what's the correct analysis. I love the way that the Buddha emphasized that all his teaching, all his dharma, is a raft to help us get to the other side. The point being, when we get to the other side, the idea isn't to say, oh, what a wonderful raft that's been. I'll pick it up and carry it around everywhere I do. But all Buddhist teachings are heuristic, right? Something we constantly need to be reminded of, I think, that becoming a Buddhist, becoming a good Zen Buddhist, that's not the solution to anything, right? It's like Buddhism offers us a path. All the teachings, there's nothing sacred about the teachings. You know, we honor them in certain ways because they can be so effective, they can be so enlightening. But fundamentally, all the Buddhist teachings, all the way back to the beginning, they're not something to put up in an altar and bow down to. They're a roadmap. They're a guidebook. They're something to help us transform ourselves, to transform today, the challenge, transforming more than ourselves. Right? So there's a kind of pragmatism built into Buddhist teachings that encourages us not to get caught up in endless theoretical debates about exactly what's the best way forward. And there's an encouragement about some kind of experimenting or being open. And the other thing that goes along with that, which I would emphasize, is the emphasis, especially on the Bodhisattva path, on skillful means. Which is, another way to talk about that is in terms of encouraging kind of creativity outside the usual bounds, and sometimes outside the usual bounds of the precepts. But, being flexible. And hopefully our practice encourages that creativity, right? A few years ago, I had a chance to met a young Zen student in New York City. He told me about what he'd been doing. He had set up an organization where he would go to the office of somebody who was running for New York State Assembly, and he would say, I'd like to know your attitude on accepting your policy on accepting contributions from corporations. Because I have compiled a list of 25,000 people, an email list of 25,000 people who have pledged not to vote for anyone who accepts corporate contributions. Oh, and by the way, you won your last election by about 15,000 votes. So could you please let us have your policy? We all want to know. I was really impressed, you know. And even if, you know, sometimes people will do things like accept donations at the very last moment. But again, they're all in one email list. Boom, at the very last moment. Legally, you have to list your contributions online, I think, and he would check that every day, and he would send it. Fantastic, you know. I love that kind of creativity. I think I regret that I've lost touch with him, but I expect he's continuing to do creative things like that. Great. I realize, though, maybe I didn't speak about the most important thing about this double-sided practice. Two important things. First of all, the way that it not only encourages we Buddhist practitioners to expand our horizons, but it also can provide something very important that can help activists who otherwise tend to burn out to ground themselves. Right? I spend a lot of time, maybe most of my time, speaking to Buddhists and just encouraging them to understand our practice in this broader context. Because so often, and I think this is understandable, so often we tend to understand the practice as sort of grounding ourselves in a certain kind of equanimity or serenity, or in Buddhism, in Zen, we talk about emptiness, right? And it's somehow as if that's somehow the goal. And in a way, I can understand it. We come to the practice because in some way we suffer. Something isn't quite right about our lives, and that's what motivates us to actually, you know, engage in this practice, to devote so much time, energy, money, sore legs, and so forth to this. And that means that at the beginning, the practice is largely just letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, as Suzuki's Roshi said, dying and dying and dying again. But there's also a danger with that in the sense that it can emphasize too much form is emptiness and not enough emptiness is form. And how we can simply think the practice is simply about opening up to this place where it's true that there's nothing to gain or lose, there's no better or worse, there's freedom, there's nothing that needs to be done. And sort of getting stuck there, clinging to emptiness. And so how important it is to move beyond that. As I tend to say now, I'm understanding emptiness not as a place to dwell, but as like a potentiality that always wants to take form in response to particular situations, which is why an expanded understanding of the Bodhisattva path is so important. So anyway, that's on the Buddhist side, right? It's not enough just to sort of dwell in emptiness and think that that's the end of the path. That's still one-sided. On the other side, though, I think we're probably all familiar with activists, people who are really concerned about social and ecological concerns and how difficult it is to avoid being burned out, to be bored, you know, frustrated, give up, despair, the tendency to become angry. And anger at that level is kind of burns you up from the inside and kind of exhausts you. And how important it is then for each of these two sides to come together. As I said in my talk yesterday at the university, it's not simply that they go well together, but that each of them is so supportive of the other. So how important it is in our personal practice not just to sit on our butts facing the wall, but to actually get up and engage in the world, and that is an essential part of our self-transformation, even if we look at it in personal terms. But for the activist, how important it is to realize that if they can ground their activism in some kind of personal transformative practice, if they can understand it in sort of spiritual terms, if they can understand, again, that this practice can have two sides, then how much the meditation or the mindfulness, even if they don't understand it spiritually, how really important that can be in sort of stabilizing or grounding them in something that sustains them even in times of great difficulty. Does that make any sense? Yeah. And that brings me to the main point and the last point that I want to make. Another way to understand what I've just said, or kind of the culmination of that, is that because bodhisattvas have this individual grounding practice, they are able to act in the world sincerely and give it their full effort without being attached to the results of what they're doing. And I think that that's really important, because when we're attached to the results, there's a kind of frustration built in there. But it's also something that's very easily misunderstood. So I want to end by saying a few words about that. When I say non-attachment to the results, I don't mean that we don't work as hard as we can for those results. You know, you could have a kind of attitude where you say, you know, yeah, I know our local power plant needs to convert from coal to renewables. We tried, a lot of resistance, it didn't work. But, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, we know that intention, motivation is the important thing. So, you know, we at a certain point, we gave it up. There, if we misunderstand the point about non-attachment to the results, it can encourage a kind of casualness and a half-heartedness that I think is really self-defeating, that's part of the problem, not the solution. So I want to offer, again, as a way of concluding here, a couple different ways of understanding what it means to be non-attached to the results of our efforts. One of them is by making the distinction between running a 100-meter dash and running a marathon. When you run a 100-meter or 100-yard dash, the only thing that matters is getting to the other end as quickly as possible. There's really sort of no time to think about anything else, right? But you can't run a marathon that way, or so my marathon running friends tell me, right? I mean, you're going to burn yourself out really, really quickly, right? Instead, what they say is, yeah, there's a goal out there, 26 some miles away, and you're running in that direction, but because you're running in that direction, you don't have to think about the goal all the time. In fact, you can't think about the goal all the time. Rather, what's important is rather to be right here and right now. Just this step, just this step, just this step. In Japanese, we have this lovely term, tada, right? Just this step. So in a way, yeah, you're working toward the goal, but that's not really the main thing that's on your mind. You're running in the right direction. It's not as though you're sitting by the path, lying down saying, oh, you don't need to go anywhere. There's not that sort of attitude. There's the effort. But nonetheless, you're completely one with what you're doing right now. Maybe another example would be Thich Nhat Hanh's washing the dishes. You can wash the dishes to get done and watch TV, or you can wash the dishes to wash the dishes, right? To be completely one with the non-dual activity. And especially in the case of running, it's quite interesting the way that some of them say, when you really run in this fashion, where it's just this, ta-da, you sometimes attain this runner's high, where there's a kind of effortlessness about it. It's almost as if you're sort of floating or hovering above the body. It's not the usual mind has to push or make the body run, but there's a certain kind of the mind and the body are one, and it's just happening sort of by itself. It's a very Taoist concept too, the idea of wei wu wei, the action of non-action. I mean, it's really, in Zen we really talk about it in the sense of emptiness. The running is empty. It's not that there's a self that's doing it, but there's just the running. Just the running, which means there's just this sup, just this sup, just this sup. So that's the first meaning of non-attachment to results, in the sense that our practice encourages us to focus on right here and now. Rather, you know, we're going in a certain direction, but if we're preoccupied with that, we're missing something about the here and the now, and we're much more likely to be discouraged. Does that make any sense? Yeah. But what about, now, a marathon, 26 miles, I think, and something, there's still a goal. And even if you're a slow runner, as I would be, you know, you're still, if you keep going in the right direction, even if you're walking fast, you're going to get there, right, within the day. But what about if there's no particular goal point? What about if there's no end point to it? Can one run in the same way? What I'm thinking about are our bodhisattva vows. Living beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Whoa! What's that about? Vowing to do something that we know cannot be done, cannot be achieved, or at least in the sense of there's not a goal point we're going to get to, and you say, okay, we're all at nirvana, hey, we made it, that's great, right? All the living beings in the cosmos, no, that ain't going to happen, right? How do we understand our path in that regard? This vow to do something impossible. Is that a problem, or is that the very ground of the vow? What the vow is really talking about is not achieving some particular goal, but a reorientation of the meaning of our lives, right? So whereas normally our life is about what's in it for me, you know, a certain kind of self-absorption, how do I get out of the world what I need, the whole idea of the bodhisattva vow is sort of turning that around and saying, reorienting my life so that the meaning has to do with what can I do to make the world a better place? What can I do to help people? Again, with the realization in the back of our minds that by doing that, we're also going to be benefiting ourselves insofar as we become less selfish. So, the reason that this, I mean, to understand what that vow really means, I mean, it's life transforming. It's like, I can't think of anything more important. It's like, whoa. It's like, but here's the point for me. For someone who has really taken this vow and understands what it means, working together with other people to help humanity stop from self-destructing itself, to help humanity from destroying the biosphere and so forth, that's a kind of small subset of what the bodhisattva has vowed to do. It's like that orientation is not going to be discouraged by the fact that this is a difficult thing to do. Because why? This is what the meaning of one's life is all about. It's like that's simply what you're doing. And even if we're successful in more short-term issues like shifting from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy, it's like, okay, you do that, you just go on to the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing, indefinitely, and doing it joyfully, because that's what life is all about. Reorienting ourselves from either understanding the path as somehow transcending or escaping this reality, this world, or even reorienting ourselves from the idea that the goal is simply to become as enlightened as I can, understanding that in kind of the self-centered way, right? I mean, that's why we say the bodhisattva path really begins with the arising of bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, the mind that wants to be awakened, but also the mind that is awakened. The idea of bodhicitta is something that arises spontaneously, non-dually, this urge to become awakened, not just for one's own sake, but for the sake of everyone. Sometimes that's called a stage of enlightenment itself, and maybe it's the most important stage, because if we really incorporate that into our lives, then I think everything else sort of follows naturally in due course. Yeah. But let me finish by talking about one more sense of acting without attachment to the results of action. And I think this is an important one, because just if we think ecologically for the moment, the truth is it's very possible that we're in a difficult situation now. Not just difficult, what am I pointing at? Climate scientists don't always like to talk about this in public, but the truth is we're not only in a situation where civilization as we know it may break down because of the increase in temperatures and what that's going to mean, but also some people think that even our own species, that there's a real possibility that the human species might go extinct, which seems very odd given how creative and inventive we are. But nonetheless, one fundamental problem, just to put it most basically, is that at less than 100 degrees temperature, if you're in 100 degrees in full humidity or what's called wet bulb conditions, the human body begins to break down after about 6 hours. I mean, this could be really bad. And when you look at the possibility that we are approaching or maybe have even already passed certain tipping points, where you get kind of positive reinforcements, just like where the, you know, when the ice melts in the poles, the ice and the snow reflect a lot of the sun's radiation and heat, but when it melts, then the ocean absorbs it, and then it gets warmer, and then more ice melts, and you get this positive feedback loop. The one that actually concerns me the most, and I've been reading a lot about it lately, is methane, that we have huge amounts of methane gas buried in the permafrost, which is now melting, and in the bottom of the Arctic seas. And by huge amounts, one estimate is over 400 billion tons. And the problem is that methane is much, much more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, between 23 and 70 some times more potent. In other words, if the methane melts, the tipping point, the feedback loop, means that temperatures could rise very, very quickly indeed within a generation or two. Right. So what does that mean? What does it mean, the possibility of human civilization or even human extinction? What does that imply? We just don't know. We don't know what's coming down. We just don't know. And, of course, conventionally, that not knowing can be very discouraging, can be very disempowering. We just don't know. But it's an interesting phrase, isn't it? We just don't know. But wait a minute. Does that sound familiar? We just don't know. Isn't that just don't know mind what we encourage in our Zen practice? What does Bernie Glassman write? The Zen peacemakers, don't know mind is the first of their principles. Acknowledging that we don't know. I'm reminded of something one of my teachers, Robert Aiken, said. He said, our path isn't about clearing up the mystery, but making the mystery clear. The mystery of not knowing, right? That the kind of transformation, the opening up. It's not about, now I understand everything about the nature of the world. Now I've figured it all out. No, it's about letting go of what we do know and opening up to this extraordinary mystery that is the world, that is our own lives. The mystery including things like karma. The mystery that we don't know what's possible. And it's really important to emphasize this, I think, because this is the larger context. This needs to be understood in relationship to this other wonderful koan, where the student asks the master, you know, what's the constant activity of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? What is it that they're doing all the time? Maybe the student had some idea that they had sort of magical special powers that they were using day to day or something. And the answer of the Roshi, though, or the master, is simply, what are they doing? They're responding appropriately. Our practice is what enables us to be aware of what's going on and responding appropriately. Of course, in a Zen center, that's easy to do. The bell rings, we know to put on our robes and go into the Zendo. But when you leave the Zen center and you go out into a world in crisis, a world in ecological breakdown, a world in social and economic breakdown, what does it mean to respond appropriately? The point is we need to do the best we can according to the best that we understand, but nonetheless it's enshrouded in this larger mystery where we don't know what's possible. We don't even know what's happening right now. So I remember some of us here grew up in the Cold War, right? Where we took for granted that this Cold War could at any moment turn into a hot war that would destroy civilization and maybe humanity with a nuclear, you know, nuclear exchange, right? I'll bet Tigan also remembers the Cuban Missile Crisis. I sure do. Yeah, and how close we came to mutually assured destruction at that point, right? And we just took that for granted. That's the world. And then, boom, one day, it all collapsed. It's like it seemed like overnight, almost all the communist world collapsed. And the whole worldview that we had taken for granted, just sort of that whole struggle wasn't there, at least not in that form. It was quite amazing. That's not to say that nuclear dangers are alleviated, but that whole conception of the world, South Africa too. It felt like one day Mandela was in jail, serving a life sentence, and the next day he was president of South Africa. It's like, whoa, what's going on here? You know, my point here is we don't really know what's possible until we try. And our action is not, okay, I know what's possible, but our acting is our acting in the face of that. And that's non-attachment to action. You see, we don't really know what's possible, and that's okay. And maybe this is the best way to sum it up. Our job, our task, is to do the very best we can, not knowing if anything we do makes any difference whatsoever. That's our task as bodhisattvas, as people trying to follow that path. Again, our job is to do the very best we can, not knowing if it makes any difference whatsoever. Have we already passed ecological tipping points and civilization as we know it is doomed? We don't know, and that's okay. Of course, we hope our efforts will bear fruit, but ultimately, all of our efforts are our gifts to the earth, our gifts gratis to the cosmos, as it were. We do what we do because it's what needs to be done. It's what we are called upon to do. It's what we're here for. We don't know if what we do is important. But we do know that it's important for us to do it. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief, said Rabbi Tarfon. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. It's not your responsibility to finish the work of Tikkun Olam, healing the earth, healing the world. But you are not free to desist from it either. This famous saying is in the Jewish Mishnah, and the fact that it's from a religious text, I think, is very important. Again, we're talking about a fundamentally spiritual attitude cultivated in our zazen, cultivated in our practice. That's what enables us to engage in the world that way. It's very difficult, maybe almost impossible, to act in the world in that way unless you have some kind of spiritual orientation, some kind of spiritual grounding. Those committed to activism need the patience, perseverance, serenity, and insight that the bodhisattva path cultivates. Of course, to be so unattached to the results of our efforts is to set the bar very high. Unrealistically high, maybe. Perhaps no one is able to embody this fully. This double practice fully, any more than any of us is ever going to perfect the six perfections of the the paramitas of the bodhisattva path. And that's okay too. The point is not to be perfect, but to do the best we can. In conclusion, let me just repeat something I said earlier, that I wonder if this conception of activism that brings together personal transformative practice with engagement in the world, I wonder if this is maybe the most important thing that our tradition has to offer at this particular point, given that there is this larger immune system of the earth, that you know we are part of a much larger group of groups that are working for sustainability and social justice. Is this maybe what's distinctive, what the Buddhists can offer, emphasizing the importance of bringing these two sides of the practice together? Is the earth today calling upon all of us to become bodhisattvas and ecosattvas? Are we getting to the point where, in a way, that's like the only path in town? The only As things begin to fall apart, the more it's going to cut through our usual sort of preoccupations, which tend to take for granted that things are going to stay kind of the same. Things ain't going to stay the same, right? We're in for some tough times ahead. And I think our practice and our conception of the bodhisattva path could be a very, very important part of that. The other thing, which I didn't have time to go into, but it's worth just mentioning, is the importance of Sangha. You know, I think in American Buddhism, we have a lot of Buddhas. You know, of the three treasures, we have a lot of Buddha teachers. We have a lot of Dharma teachings. What we're weak, and I see this especially in Zen, is Sangha, the idea of community. When things get really difficult, maybe the most important thing will not be those bags of brown rice and lentils in our basement, but whether we're part of a loving community of people who are willing to be there for each other. Anyway, as a last comment, it seems to me that what I've just talked about, if contemporary Buddhists, if contemporary Zen practitioners don't want to respond in this way to our situation, then don't want to, can't, whatever reason, if we can't respond to this challenge that we're being given, then I would say Buddhism, Zen, is not what the earth needs right now. But of course, what I've tried to say is that I think the bodhisattva path has a great deal to offer. The question is whether we're going to respond to this invitation, whether we're going to embody it and how we actually live. Whether we're going to respond to this greatest challenge that maybe humanity has ever faced.
Thank you very much, David. So, time. If anyone has comments, questions, responses, please feel free.
Thank you for your talk. I'm going to ask a question that I believe you've addressed, but to me it's a very important one, and I would ask you to kind of expand, if you wouldn't mind. I'm often very inspired when I hear about bodhisattvas, bodhisattva path, and simultaneously I also feel a certain type of nervousness, because I think that when we say that something is the bodhisattva path, or if we say that we are bodhisattvas or they are bodhisattvas, if we're not very aware that these are simply figures of speech, it's easy to kind of slip into this delusion of self that I am the one who's doing this for all beings. And in these cases, it's not, in my opinion, that's simply basic delusion and self-righteousness masquerading as the bodhisattva. So my question is, could you give advice on how people who do care and do find this presentation very resonant, how we can avoid being blinded by our own concepts?
By concepts, do you mean?
Well, when we say, for example, beings are numberless, I, thou, freedom. How do we avoid slipping when we say that I, or how do we say when we say bodhisattva path?
Yeah.
How do we avoid being caught by those words?
Yeah. I think that's actually the genius of the bodhisattva path, because it doesn't involve sacrificing our own personal transformative practice, which is what works on the ego, right? It's like, you know, you're basically talking about, okay, our ego can still come in and, you know, what a great bodhisattva I am and so forth. And the whole point of the emphasis on the contemplative is that that's what works on, that what works, you know, so that we have that practice as kind of a reference point to keep us from getting caught up in that kind of problem, which is not to say that it's not a constant sort of, as it were, danger, but nonetheless one needs to, you know, the practice is what encourages us to keep engaging with that. I think it was it Rinzai who said, when you know who you are, then you are good for something. You know, we really have to be very careful. I mean, it's easy to get caught up in the compassion aspect. And I remember Bhikkhu Bodhi saying this, that, you know, Westerners, we love compassion. Let me help you. Right? And how there's a certain kind of patronizing quality that's dangerous there. And again, hopefully the practice, the teachings, the teacher will catch us there, right? The two other things worth mentioning, I mentioned very briefly the bodhicitta. That is something deeper than self. It's like it's an urge. It's not, oh, wouldn't it be nice to help every, it's really an opening to something deeper than ego that springs up. But the other thing which people like Joanna Macy emphasize, what can really cut through all of that, and it's really necessary to act in the ways that are needed, is opening up to our grief for the world. You know, if we don't do that, then it's very hard to avoid it being some kind of a game to some degree. And the point is, as Joanna Macy says, it's important not to repress our grief, our emotional response to what's actually happening to the world, not just ecologically, but we could say economically, politically, and feeling that. And we're afraid of that. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons for the resistance to climate change and so forth, that there's a real fear to go there, and yet if our practice is good for anything, it's helping us cope with that, right? It's not, our practice isn't about avoiding suffering. It's about opening up to it and facing it. And that grief can really be very important in cutting through a lot of the ego stuff, you know. That's all I can say.
I really agree with you that you know, Buddhist practice and the practice of Sangha as well can be a place to gain, you know, sort of an orientation and an inspiration and some tools for being active and awake and working for beneficial you know, outcomes in the world. I feel like a challenge for Sanghas is how to refrain from making particular actions or particular causes important, and you know, so that we then, you know, wind up alienating people who don't agree with that particular cause,
yeah.
And we somehow become, you know, our own political action coalition. You know, and I wonder,
yeah,
if you have any words,
yeah,
for how to refrain from that, because that's
right,
so easy to fall into with like-minded people who are trying to do something positive and are trying to encourage each other.
Yeah.
But I think we can't really completely know that one way is, you know,
mm-hmm,
the right way.
Right. And that, you know, people, I mean, we want to create a place where people of all political persuasions feel comfortable, really. In the belief that the kind of transformation that happens when we practice is really, really important. I mean, so my sense is, it's important that the practice, the actual practice of Zazen, the practice of Zen, the teaching of Zen, it's important that be distinguished from the social activism and the ecological activism. And I think there's naturally going to be a lot of overlap, but not in the sense that people who are reluctant to go in that direction feel unwelcome. So, you know, one can have a Zendo, and then most of the same people can be engaged in a march or something, but somehow the expectation that one needs to do that should not be built into the practice. And also, people are at different stages. I mean, always, and that's part of what I'm saying is respecting that, so that, you know, putting pressure on people is really going to be counterproductive too, I think. Yeah. But, you know, your question is a really important one, because I think many, many centers in one form or other face that. I remember Robert Aiken in Hawaii, he had some trouble with that. You know, he was very leftist, very activist, and, you know, occasionally people felt it was a little uncomfortable. It was entering too much into the Dharma hall. Yeah. Now, so those are general principles. In actually applying them, you know, is tricky. You know, does that mean that every Dharma talk should never say something that is politically or socially or ecologically relevant? You know, it's kind of a tricky thing, especially once we understand dukkha, suffering, in the broad sense of structural, systemic suffering. Then, so the principle is there. In reality, it may not be so easy to finesse the dividing line between them. Yeah.
Sorry,
was what I said so clear, everyone? Did I persuade everyone so easily? Or am I talking to the converted here, Terry?
You mentioned our activism and perhaps the need to become more cutting edge in relationship to nonviolent actions. Mm. And I'm hearing more about that need, and it has felt like some of our actions, particularly in our marches, are a little milquetoast-ish, a little not edgy enough to cause something.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm even hearing people talk about militancy. I don't like that word, but something even more
yeah,
and be curious. You
yeah, yeah,
thought about that, particularly from a Buddhist perspective.
Yeah,
I've heard. Kyoto Williams, Angel Kyoto Williams,
right,
talking about that also.
That's right.
Really interested.
Yeah.
In what's your thoughts?
I mean, I agree. There's a danger of just being sort of kind of bland, like, you know, we go to the marches when we can, sort of thing. And that's why I mentioned sort of nonviolent resistance. I mean, I think from a Buddhist perspective, that's something we shouldn't cross, you know. I mean, I don't think property is sacred, but nonetheless, I don't see that it's that effective a kind of a strategy either, to sort of go around trashing windows, you know, running down streets like some of the, you know, some people would do. So I think the emphasis is on nonviolence, but that doesn't say that you don't put your body on the line, right? So sit-ins and sort of really, you know, really getting in the way. And I mean, I think it's tricky. The other side to remember, of course, is when we're ever tempted to violence, the other side has such more violence, right? It's like the danger is that in the eyes of many people, you're losing legitimacy. It's going to be easy to put you in a certain kind of a box, to label you as terrorists. So, I mean, I think from a Buddhist perspective, nonviolent resistance may well be necessary, but I think there's lots and lots of reasons, both sort of moral and tactical, to be very careful about crossing into actual violence.
Yeah.
Does that help? I mean, at this level of abstraction, you know, what the issue is really sort of what in particular does one have in mind? You know, the whole Antifa thing. How does that play out? You know? And I don't know that I have any special thing to offer.
Just in closing,
please.
We will have. We're not doing temple cleaning today, and we'll have time. We'll have tea and cookies and a time to meet and talk personally with David and to possibly buy books and have consignment. Just to say a little bit about our Sangha and our situation. I think a lot of people individually in our Sangha are doing various social action things and exploring how to do that. And we don't have any Sangha policies about things that people have to do, but people are exploring programs around Dharma and racism. People, individuals have been involved in various actions. I think you're right that we may need to do more, some of us, but I think many of us are trying to see what is reasonable in Chicago and to address the issues that we have locally, and I think we're going to continue to be exploring this, and I really appreciate your talking about systemic sources of suffering, and people here will continue to continue doing caregiving as well. So this is going to be an ongoing issue for us, but I appreciate your support and input for this. So we'll close formally with our version of the 4 Bodhisattva vows.
Oh, cool.